Nick Girton is Director of Transformation in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, Test, and Evaluation. And he is a co-author, along with Howard Reichel, of a piece for the Acquisition Research Symposium called Open Systems Architecture License Rights, a New Era for the Public-Private Marketplace. And the views that he and Howard express in this piece are their own and don't represent the views of the Department of Defense. Nick, it is terrific to have you back on the program today. Let's start with the broad concept of intellectual property and then get at the unique way that you and Howard go about presenting some ideas about it. What's the overwhelming concept about intellectual property that you're trying to deal with both at the Navy and your colleagues across the other branches of the military?
Yes, and Francis, thanks for having me on again. It's an exciting opportunity. So intellectual property is something that everyone is familiar with. It's in everything we buy. When we go to the store, we are familiar with it when it comes to apps we download or music we buy. And the way we've looked at it in how we acquire our defense systems has been not exactly the same way that everybody deals with it in their normal lives. And because in great part, it's because the government is creating the need and paying for these wonderful warfighting products to be made available to our warfighters. So it puts us in a very different situation between who wants stuff and how and who pays for stuff. And what we tried to do in this paper was pull on those different ideas. Who's the consumer? Who's the buyer? And this notion of a venture capitalist. Where is the money coming from and what is it used for? And what benefit does the venture capitalist get out of being the investor, being the place where the money comes to keep those juices flowing? And then finally, we played off what is the nation's best interest in generating intellectual property and managing competitive markets for specifically for defense systems?
So, and that phrase strikes me as the critical difference between what IP means and how important it is in a federal acquisition space compared to the private sector. Because if you and if you're a private sector company and I'm a private sector company and we're doing some kind of IP business, the interest of the country doesn't really matter. The interests that we decide our companies have or the interest that I as a consumer decide that I have when I do a transaction with you as a company are all that really matter. That interest of the nation is kind of a third factor that's in between that transition between you as somebody in the Navy and me as a potential company doing business with the Navy. It seems to me, at least. Am I on target there?
Absolutely. And the additional tension is that, you know, we are investing on behalf of the taxpayer. And so the taxpayer, our job is to kind of protect that investment, to make sure we can take advantage of the outcome of spending that money and, you know, drive down costs and increase innovation. So that puts us in a slightly different situation between our suppliers and our and the consumer, which is ultimately the defense of the nation.
So I'm going to give you two intellectual property examples in a private sector or commercial environment, and I'm going to ask you to talk about the differences or similarities to how something like that would work in the defense sector. One is an item that I buy, a widget, and there's a patent on that widget, and I go buy it, and I can take that home and do whatever the widget was designed to do, and I own that piece of equipment now. Mm-hmm. So if I want to give it to my neighbor, or if I want to sell it at a yard sale or put it on eBay or whatever, when I'm finished doing whatever task I wanted to do with it, I'm allowed to do that. That's one example. Another example is, say I download a song from iTunes, and that's intellectual property. That's a creation that an artist did through distributed through a record label and then through iTunes. I can't sell that, though. I buy a license to be able to use that. And when I don't want to use it anymore, I don't own that the way that I used to own a CD. And that's been a source of a lot of contention that we don't have time to talk about here. But those are different concepts of intellectual property and ways that they can be leveraged, the ways that the end user can do something with them. How is your role as the end user at the Department of Defense different in similar examples to that?
So we have some of those same pieces going on in the way we buy these defense systems. And so it's a kind of a mashup of different kinds of IP. We have the physical product, the warfighting thing, but it's got other stuff inside it. Sometimes it's commercial things. Sometimes it's things that were created out of, you know, unique corporate investments. And in a very great way, it represents the investment of the taxpayer for some unique military capability. So as a result, we end up with this amorphous blob of different things, and then we try to do our due diligence of applying competition across the life cycle of these products when it's all mashed up together. So what we tried to explore in this paper was how to peel those different pieces apart and look at how we compete them differently.
You can find a link to that paper, Open Systems Architecture License Rights, A New Era for the Public-Private Marketplace. Nick Girton of the Navy and Howard Reichel of In-Depth Engineering wrote it together. It represents their views and not those of the Department of Defense. You can find a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The concept that you and Howard write about here is pretty cool, because I've never seen anybody tie defense acquisition to the Shark Tank television program before. How did you see a parallel there, and how did you go about exploring that to put it into words here?
So I'll have to credit Howard's intellectual innovation with that. he knew about that show before I did, and he exposed it to me. He said, "You got to watch this thing. I think we got a hook here somewhere," because we had been talking about writing a paper together, but weren't sure how to propel it forward and make it digestible to someone reading it. Now make it maybe a little bit more exciting than a classic acquisition research paper. So I had to watch the show, and as I did, I was like, wow, that's really interesting, because now I can see how, you know, people with money invest in things, and then they want to be able to see how can they make their money make more money. And they classically look at, you know, is this is something I'm going to invest in this company and get some equity out of it, or is there a way to maybe license that intellectual property and make money by, you know, selling multiple copies of it in some way? And so as I looked at that, and we tried to map it against what we do in how we work with government, within government, and interact with industry, and then we could see how those parallels played out. And we could also see how we are in a transitionary period right now between how we can take advantage of things like one of my favorite topics, open systems architecture, where we have a greater understanding of the how these things are made up, what the pieces are and how the interface, how we can use competitive leverage at a more granular level than an entire ship or an entire aircraft. We can use competition down inside the systems, inside those military capabilities. So now we can start to have a more fruitful interaction and look at how we do competition at a more risk-prudent level, but now informed by how the competitive dynamics work in a regular transaction, regular commercial transaction that we're all familiar with.
I like that term risk prudent, because it implies that you're willing to expose yourself as someone in the Department of Defense. And I'm not talking about you personally, but that the Navy and the other components are willing to expose themselves to some risk if it appears that the return on the potential return on that risk is worth taking that chance. There's a perception in industry right now, and it's not just against DOD, it's against the entire federal government, that nobody's really willing to take much of a risk right now. And that seems to be one of the holdups that that companies believe is holding agencies back from realizing some of the innovation that they say they want to try to get to.
So in this paper, we created a set of vignettes where we looked at different types of market dynamics. First, we did kind of a classic Shark Tank, a fictional intellectual property creation. You know, you step into the TV show, and this is the way it works. And we saw enough of these things where we could see how the different sharks, that is the investors, the venture capitalists, might negotiate with the innovator and against each other for getting the best deal. And then we saw, well, it's not exactly the way it works in defense acquisition. In the past, we've taken a military capability gap, a need of the warfighter, and we mapped that into a system. And then we would contract for that system, and we would award a contract, and we'd pretty much stay with that guy for a long time and really not have the ability to use competitive leverage except for the whole thing. which for some of these things, some of our systems, they're big and they're very expensive. And to compete out the whole thing all at once simply isn't risk prudent in many cases. So we are looking for how do we show that decomposition of our business risk into smaller pieces that we could then apply business logic to.
I thought of exactly what you're talking about there as I read through one of your examples. One of the examples that you use, the fictional person who comes to the agency says, I can't compete to produce this entire weapon system, but since you've modularized it and since you've broken it down into pieces, I'm able to compete on this one particular area. It sounds like what you're getting at here.
So that kind of dynamic opens up opportunities for us to not just compete the components, but also to use different market opportunities. We might be able to use small businesses in a different way, or perhaps non-traditional defense suppliers. I'm not going to sound a bell that defense contractors are in some kind of trouble here, because they continue to innovate. They continue to stay on their feet. They're paying attention. They're looking at how do they change their product offerings to government so that they can stay competitive and continue to provide us excellent systems.
So the Shark Tank show, what happens is a company comes on and describes what he or she, the owner of a company comes on and describes what he or she has to offer and asks these business people with a lot of money to invest in their company. And they have very specific requests as far as how much money they need and what they are going to do with it. And the sharks, as you mentioned, then make them offers, sometimes offering what the person wants and sometimes offering different formats and different requirements. We have to get the intellectual property, or I have to run the company, or I get 51% of the company, or whatever. There are any mm-hmm. number of different possibilities. How did you go about these six scenarios? Standard commercial, commercial variant for federal customer, legacy DOD, awkward transition, which is the one I want to talk about next, small business innovative research, and open systems architecture business model. How did you decide that those were the ones that you wanted to highlight in this Shark Tank context?
So, by the way, giving due deference to Shark Tank TV show by ABC, we wanted to show how this idea was accessible and then set up kind of the classic pattern that people go through in order to create the vehicle by which we would describe the other business cases. And then we looked at how would this be different if the federal government was the customer. And as it turns out, Howard had been in an executive in Department of Homeland Security, and he was familiar with how that worked with other federal entities, and so he was able to bring that to the table. And then we both have a lot of experience in developing defense products. The big difference between a standard commercial product and how a regular federal customer works as opposed to defense customers, at least in Howard's experience, many of those suppliers really didn't want to do development on behalf of the government. They really wanted to go get their own venture capital because they didn't want to have their intellectual property be tied to government dollars. They wanted to be able to market it independently to a lot of different customers all over the place without having to worry about the government sharing that intellectual property. That's a big difference because in defense systems, they're unique to, the protection of the nation. And so we are the investor, and we do protect the investment by capturing information and being able to share that information with others. That's a practice we haven't applied a lot of rigor to in the past, and we're trying to get a better handle on it. So we unwound the timeline a little bit and looked back to back in the days when we built our own computers. We in defense built our own computers, I think 30 years ago easily. And how did that apply? And then that helps set up the fact that we are kind of in an awkward place because we still think about how we build these systems like we were building our own computers. We built the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. But we're not building things anymore all ourselves, but some of our acquisition processes still map to that time. And so we peel that apart a little bit and show how we really have some unnatural tensions in our marketplace right now, and that's what that awkward transition period is about.
Yeah, you write, you and your colleague Howard Reichel write, we enter this round of the Shark Tank in an awkward interim state in which the Navy acquisition community wants to move forward toward an open systems architecture business model, but recognizes the evolution to this business model isn't a linear progression from the legacy model that you talked about earlier in this piece. Making that transition, the reason I go to this one first is because this it seems to me where you're trying to make the break from the way you've done it before,
right,
and transition toward ultimately the open systems architecture for everything that you and I have talked about before. Am I on track?
Oh, yeah. So in like I said, in the times past, we would have this military capability requirement, and we would map that into a capability need, and we would then contract for that. But the contract would be massive. It would be a single award, and we'd take that through idea incubation into producing an actual system. Then we'd try to compete it later. Not a whole lot of success sometimes because these systems are getting more and more complicated. And getting another vendor to come in and be able to compete toe-to-toe with somebody who all created something very complex and very capable, sometimes we don't end up with a lot of competitive alternatives. And so breaking the business problem apart into more granular pieces will help us get the kind of market dynamics we're looking for that are more aligned to the market dynamics we see when we go buy systems at, say, Best Buy or something like that.
The next one is the SBIR semi-commercial transaction, and that indicates the transition to eventually where you want to go, which is a full-blown open systems architecture business model. Why is that system and that way of doing business, that model, why does it have to be more complex than the Defense Department or a component of DOD just buys the intellectual property from whoever comes up with it and then makes it available to anybody to get past that model that you just talked about where the non-incumbents aren't encumbered by all of the costs to develop the IP?
So let's talk about Swiss cheese a little bit. So these systems are made up of lots of things from lots of places. Some things are real-life commercial stuff, and some things are things the government invested in uniquely, and therefore we should be able to capture the fruits of those dollars. But there are some things that have been placed in those systems, not nefariously, just the way we've done business, that were individual company unique investments that came from internal resources or things that people put together on their own, and they should enjoy some exclusivity of that creation. And we want to honor that. We want to honor that innovation because that adds, as Lincoln said, the fuel of fire to our genius that gets us people wanting to create new things. So we end up with these systems that are kind of a tapestry of different pieces. And because they're all mixed up together, we can't just take the whole piece of Swiss cheese and hand it off to the next guy because there's holes in it, the things that were commercial, the things that were privately invested. So it tends to be more complicated. So the way we uncouple ourselves from that complication is by creating these modular interfaces, these boundaries upon which we can apply alternative business logic.
You and your colleague Howard write, the Navy's Open Systems Architecture Technical Framework is analogous to the Apple and Android Open Environment or the Ford SYNC. Tell me about how that analogy works.
So, not to call out Ford specifically, because other car manufacturers are trying to do this too, although I did buy a Ford recently. I'm very happy with it. So you can go download a software development kit for, you know, creating an Apple app or an Android, something you'd buy in Google Play, or perhaps even something you might promote to Ford that you could perhaps upload into my car.
Mm-hmm.
And because they have established the technology framework, kind of how this system is going to work, and then also created knowledge products for alternative suppliers to figure out how do I build stuff that will work inside these systems. I mean, you can go off and build an app and put it in the app store and I might buy it. But that didn't happen by accident. Those companies had to think through, well, how is this system put together? How do I make information available to others so that they can create wonderful stuff that will run on my system? We need to do a lot of those same things. At least that's the assertion that Howard and I make, is we need to create those same kinds of technical frameworks for the mission systems we put in our military capabilities. And it turns out that is something that's also supported, at least in Navy policy and the Navy's open architecture strategy, that we are moving toward creating this notion of technical reference architectures that we could then use as classes of places to start from, so not every system is a complete, unique, creative body of work.
One of the conclusions that you reach in this paper, and we have it linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, is you propose an open systems architecture license right, OSALR. Explain what that means, explain what you would have as the Department of the Navy, and explain what the vendor would have as the person supplying you with some IP.
So this is about establishing a different kind of win-win environment where that technical framework in the context of, say, an Apple iPhone or a Google Android or Ford or GM or whoever else car manufacturers have these open environments where people can come in and play, that those technical frameworks need to be established. But not just established, but nurtured and managed and grown, because we want our military capabilities to improve over time. Well, that's not going to happen by accident. That is also intellectual property that people need to bring to the table. But we want to offer a different value proposition to the suppliers of these systems and saying, bring your IP, bring your unique investment, and we'll find a different way to remunerate that investment, but you need to do something for us too. Otherwise, we're just going to go back to our old ways of doing business, and we're going to cut checks, you're going to build this stuff, we're going to capture that through the government's rights to data, and we're going to share it with your competitors. Let's do this a different way, we propose, that you bring us some IP, but you also help us build out this framework so that we could build this system out of different building blocks that we might get from different companies. And as associates, that is, different companies that bring us these building blocks, you together help make that foundation grow, establish and grow, and so that we can bring continuing innovation excellence to the warfighting community.
This idea is included in a paper called Open Systems Architecture License Rights, A New Era for the Public-Private Marketplace. You and your colleague, Howard Reichel of In-Depth Engineering, presented this at the Acquisition Research Symposium, Nick. Your views in this paper are your own, not those of DOD. In your role, though, at DOD, you are taking this one step forward with a war game on intellectual property. And now you and I talked about some of the crowdsourcing stuff that you've done in the past and the results that you got from that. Tell me how this war game will work and what the end result is that you'd like to achieve from it.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a war game environment last summer. And it was very successful. It helped us understand better how to move the ball forward in terms of the Navy's implementation of open system architecture. And we were looking at how do we motivate the government and how do we incentivize industry. And one of the things that came out of that game was the need to have a different way of approaching intellectual property. And to a certain extent, that's what birthed the notion of this paper and some other works that we're doing in support of better buying power. But we need more information. We need different ideas to help us understand how to move that forward. And what we found from running the innovation game last summer was there's people out there that can help us with that. And the idea of using a crowdsource to find those ideas is compelling and productive. The way it works is we take a little time to think about how to set up the game, and we're in the process of doing that now, where we set up seed cards, where these are the different starting points of conversation. And then we, in places like this, let people know about the game is going to happen. And we're going to put a link on the website to help people understand how to register for the game.
Happy to.
And so that they'll come in and they'll look at this idea, this seed card, and say, ah, I've got something I can innovate on that, or I can add some additional information, or I can refute it and say, well, that's just a bad idea, or I can build on it. So we can do one of those four things on that first seed card, and we'll have several of these seed cards set up. And so we will have these discussion threads that birth out of that beginning place, and as these discussion threads unfold, we have some people called game masters that will look over the top of the game and see as it unfolds and say, wow, you guys, you handful of people, your subset of the gamers now have created a new idea. And we want you now to take that a step further and create an action plan. So we start with seed cards. Those create cards that are played against the seed card. Those collect together into super interesting ideas. That's what it's called in the game environment. And those super interesting ideas then get created into action plans. And it's the action plans that help us understand how to take advantage of the crowd's logic, about the crowd's wisdom, and push through and come up with alternative approaches, different policies, new methods, and even guidance. And we've been very successful in taking information that we got out of last summer's game and creating new guidance materials and getting it out to the acquisition workforce, getting it out to industry so they can see how to take advantage of those ideas.
What's your timeline for the game and then for being able to collect the results from this year's and turn it into something, as you just said, that you're able to apply to do something with?
So the game starts on July 14th. We'll ideate, as it's called, the first week, and we'll come up with all these different card plays, and then we'll set aside those super interesting ideas and start creating action plans. The second week will run for about 3 days. We'll finish off those action plans in the last two days, of that second week. The full crowd will come in and comment and vote on the action plans that come out in the end. So we will then start looking at the results of the game and say, do these play well? Is this something that we can actually turn into something useful? And what we experienced from the last two rounds of doing this is they're very fruitful ideas. And we're going to move forward and figure out how to take advantage of them. And I'll tell you, one of the things we're going to look at specifically is the results of this particular paper we just got through talking about is, is there a place for a new license right the government can use and a new business model for taking advantage of modularity and open architectures and defined interfaces to have a different kind of dynamic with industry? And then we'll promote that as an alternative license, and we'll put that into the machinery of government for creating new regulations.